From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Black Lives Matter movement has gained a widespread following here in the United States and also inspired movements against racism worldwide. At a time when there is a national and even international dialogue about race, racism, prejudice, and bigotry, we turn today to a behavioral scientist whose new book about implicit bias helps us understand our propensity to accept stereotypes. Dr. Pragya Agarwal is a behavioral scientist with expertise in cognition, HCI, and user-centered design, focused especially on diversity and inclusivity. She joins me to discuss her new book. It's called Sway, Unraveling Unconscious Bias. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Sonali. Good to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us. You opened your book telling a story that I found so deeply relevant to my own experience as a young girl growing up interested in science. I had almost an identical experience to what you related in the opening of your book when you were told by a male classmate that since you were a girl, you might have had trouble understanding math. I encountered this frequently in college as well. A woman, and especially a woman of color, our experiences with unconscious bias, implicit bias, racism, sexism starts at a very, very young age, right? Do you trace your studies back to your own experiences?
Yes, absolutely. I think there is still very deep ingrained gender bias in our society. And I found that myself, because I grew up in India, which is quite a patriarchal society in itself, where the birth of a girl is not celebrated. Parents want boys. I was one of three girls, and I grew
Me
up
too.
Hearing. Yeah, really. Wow. And so I grew up hearing, not from my parents who really empowered us, but from people outside, always kind of pitying us or pitying my parents because they didn't have any sons. So, and you feel like your destiny is kind of written down as soon as you're born in terms of what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to get married. Your life path is predetermined for you. And I was rebelling against the whole notion. But I find that still, I've got three girls myself now, and I've got four-year-old twins. And I find that every time I tell people I have twins, and they were like, oh, girls or boys, at least you don't have boys. And there's always this perception that boys are behave in a certain way and girls behave in a certain way. And we see that in toys and in books and how they're marketed, how they're designed, how they're written for girls and boys. And one of the children's laureate here said a few years ago that the problem is that boys don't pick up reading material which has a female protagonist, or watch movies that have got a girl as the main protagonist. So it's already kind of written down in a very subtle, implicit way that perhaps boys are in some way better than girls. And I work with a lot of children in schools and do workshops. And I already find by the age of 8 or 9, they have this whole perception that boys are better at football or girls are not as good at maths. And I think these stereotypes get so deeply ingrained. And so these biases are written down and already existing in our society. Right. But when racism and sexism intersect, there's a heightened impact on women of color because of intersectionality. And I think this is why, for me personally, when I talk about implicit biases in my book, I also talk about intersectionality and how that really exaggerates the biases that people, the prejudices that people face.
I want to get into the science of this, because that's really what you write about, which I think is so fascinating. You write, humans are not naturally rational. Information overload is exhausting and confusing. So we filter out the noise. We only see parts of the world. Are we, unfortunately, hardwired to rely on stereotypes in order to make sense of the world and therefore require extra work to overcome those stereotypes?
I think, yes, we have these kind of processes, these shortcuts inbuilt in us. And that's just to maintain or preserve some of our mental load and cognitive load. So as you quote from the book about in terms of the information that's coming up at us, it's at such a speed, we cannot process all that information on a rational level. So often what we do is that we process some of the information by in kind of a system one processing, doing some kind of a visual matching where we try and match this information to pre-existing templates. And when these pre-existing templates have been designed on the basis of our learned memories or our experiences, they might have some bias or stereotypes inbuilt in them. And it is more likely that we can fall back on errors or we can fall back on stereotypes when we do this, when we take decisions really quickly in a haste, when we are tired or when we are distracted, we fall back on these kind of templates. It doesn't necessarily mean that these are hardwired within us. It just means that our brain is designed or adapted to process information in this way, especially when we're tired, distracted, or in a hurry. But we can actively reflect on our stereotypes and make sure once we become aware of this process, we can become aware of the kind of stereotypes that we hold within us. We can really reflect on them. We can make sure that we stop ourselves from activating any of the stereotypes that we carry as well. And this is why we have to do this work of self-reflection and unlearning any of the biases that we might have picked up during a lifetime.
So just as our brains are have to deal with cognitive overload, they are also, those same brains are capable of understanding that we might have adopted stereotypes and work to overcome them. But does that end up simplifying, or does the issue of implicit bias or unconscious bias end up unfortunately becoming an excuse for racists and racism?
Yes, some people can use that. And I think this is what I was trying to do through the book, to shatter some of these myths and misconceptions around unconscious bias. Often that can be used in a very simplistic way, and people can take either say that I don't carry any biases because I'm a very fair-minded person, or they can use that to say these are just hardwired within us, which is not. We don't get racism or sexism genetically hardwired within us. These are the things we learn and unlearn, and we can unlearn. So I talk about how children pick up these stereotypes, these racist stereotypes, through as they grow older. And I've talked about that in the book. And I'm actually writing another book, which is coming out in October, about how to talk to our children about race and racism, where I talk about in the terms of developmental milestones about how as they grow older, they pick up social cues from the environment, from the other reference groups that they have around them, their families, their schools, their friends, and they start forming a sense of in-group and out-group, and they start associating certain characteristics and properties to certain kinds of people. But this happens slowly over time. This happens if they are growing up in an environment where these biases and prejudices are around them, where they see it in books, where they see it in media, where they see it in their parents and their educators. So I think that we cannot use unconscious bias or any form of bias as an excuse, because we are responsible for them. We are accountable for them. And also, I think sometimes people can use them as an excuse for systemic and structural racism as well. And even though we are individuals and we are part of the system, our individual biases feed into these systemic and structural racism. And the systemic and structural racism actually reinforce our individual biases. So this loop exists. But we still have to acknowledge that the history of the legacy of oppression has led to these structural racist policies and practices in our society that feed into our individual biases and prejudices as well. So I think we cannot use that as an excuse. No,
right.
Not at all.
Let's talk about evolutionary science and what our human evolution says about the way in which our brains respond to certain cues. And again, whether that is sometimes used as an excuse. Certainly human beings, when we're in a situation of danger, you know, scientists know that we have fight or flight reactions. We can be, you know, have sort of a sense of creating our own tribe. And, you know, as you mentioned earlier, who's in the group and who's outside the group and defending the group from outsiders. Is there a strong scientific basis in that manner in which human beings operate? And again, is that also then unfortunately used sometimes as an excuse for justifying bad behavior?
Yeah, I think, yes, you're right in terms of that being used as an excuse. What evolutionary theories tell us, and that is just kind of a research and analysis of how our ancestors might have behaved, is that they were limited resources. They were also danger of a threat of diseases being brought in from people outside who were outside their tribes or groups. So there were these strong sense of forming these in-group and out-group. This mentality was kind of built within our distant ancestors in the distant past, because they were competing for such limited resources, because they were trying to protect themselves from diseases and illnesses that they weren't aware of. And so we can say that, yes, we have this kind of primal need to stick with people who are more like us, who act like us, who think like us. And we all know about confirmation bias. This is what we do. That's why it becomes so important when we're talking about hiring, recruitment, or even forming our groups and our friendship groups and friendship circles. And we like sticking in these comfort zones where our views are being echoed back at us. And that happens in social media as well. That's why we create these echo chambers where we stick with people who have the same views with us. We retweet and tweet and like their posts. And that becomes kind of this bubble that we stick within. And so what happens is that we are never kind of exposing ourselves to dissenting views or opposite views or diverse views. And I think that evolutionary past, we should be aware of it. We should be aware that we have this tendency to do that, that we have, as humans, we carry affinity bias, we carry confirmation bias, and we have a propensity to fall into these echo chambers. And once we are aware of it, we can really start breaking out of them. But that using that as an excuse is just lazy. And I think that's just lazy behavior, because what we are saying is that we are not in control of our actions. This is just something that we are designed to do, and we are not able to choose wisely or rationally or logically in any way, and understand that we need to break out of these echo chambers at times.
How do you explain the difference to a layperson between implicit racial bias and, say, systemic or institutional racism?
Yes, so I think it's a very nuanced discussion and debate, but the systemic racism is a system of disadvantage. So that is a system of disadvantage that exists, which discriminates against certain group of people based on their skin color. And race, as we know, is a social construct. It's just a label that's been assigned to people. It has no biological basis, but the impact of race is really real. So it results in kind of racism, and it is based in this history of oppression that, because of that, some people already are at a disadvantage. There's no equity. And so when we talk about equality, we need to think about whether we even have equity. And that means things like housing discrimination or job discrimination or educational opportunities or where people live and what kind of life path is determined for them, or even in police system or legal system, the kind of discriminatory behaviors and policies and practices that are built in. And that's systemic, that's structural. That is something that we need to address at a policy level, that we need to address at kind of a more organizational level. But our individual biases are kind of have been learned through these things that we see in our society. Because there is systemic racism, it means that certain things become a norm and certain people are seen as a lower in our social hierarchy. And so when children, for instance, or people, when they're growing up and they see this, they see that in media or in books, there is a certain kind of a norm, and they assign stereotypes to people that maybe this Black people behave in a certain way, or white people behave in a certain way, or Black people are perhaps more, and there's research to show that Black men are more associated with aggressiveness and criminality, for instance, that can shape people's own unconscious biases and prejudices towards them. So I think that's how I would explain it to people, that there is a systemic racism and structural racism that exists all around us, like a smog, it's there. And that shapes also how we perceive different people, and that affects our interactions and decisions and actions as well.
So let's talk about police and the interactions between police and people of color, because that is so much in the news these days. A lot of police departments in years past, when, you know, in the wake of racist police violence, were told that they needed to be better funded so that they can fund they can find implicit bias trainings. At the same time, we see the broad disproportionality with which police target people of color, far disproportionate to their population. You write in your book about an experience that you personally had about a decade ago when you and your daughter had the police called on you because you were reported as looking suspicious or looking like shoplifters. So you have personal experience with sort of being victimized by people who called the police on you. So is it enough to just have implicit bias training on police?
No, I don't think so. I don't personally think so. And I write about it, the training, the notion of training and training out of implicit biases in my book as well. I have a problem with how some of these unconscious bias trainings are designed and run as well. And I write about that in the book, about how it becomes such a box-ticking, tokenistic exercise. It's like a performative thing sometimes. People are made to sit through this one-hour test, online test, or maybe even two-hour or something, and they think that they've been cured out of unconscious or implicit bias. You get a score or you get a certificate that you've attended it. And that's just not enough. First of all, I think that is why we need to start, they need to start looking at a policy level, at an organizational level, about how systemic bias or structural prejudices against Black people is kind of inbuilt within the police system, about the kind of policies that are there that really specifically target Black people and how they're more likely to be incarcerated or even just arrested or picked and get into the legal system. Once they get into the system, it's very hard to get out of the system. And so we need to start thinking about it from a policy level. And that has to be a top-down approach. It cannot just work by giving people a 1 hour or 2 hour or half a day training. And then there has to be a space for an ongoing conversation among the police officers, among in any organization, but especially the police, to talk about the stereotypes that people carry. And often that can be a very tricky conversation because nobody wants to put their hands up and say, I have the stereotype that Black people are more likely to be a criminal, and that's why I'm more likely to shoot or arrest them, and they're more likely to think that they look suspicious. They're not going to talk about it until and unless they create non-judgmental spaces where they can talk openly about these stereotypes they carry. And then there has to be a mechanism to reflect on these biases and to address them really actively. Once we start acknowledging the stereotypes that we carry and the biases that we carry, then it is more likely that we will be mindful of them when we are in very quick decision mode and we are falling back on instincts and we are more likely to fall back on the stereotypes and we are more likely to put these checks in place to say, I'm not going to activate some of the stereotypes or I'm going to correct for some of the stereotypes that I might have in me. And so I think it has to be a two-pronged process. There has to be an organizational policy level discussion. There has to be an individual level reflective discussion, which has to be an ongoing process.
I want to talk about technology and social media, which you also write about in your book. When we think about these echo chambers that we create, there are online forums that police officers, current and former police officers, post in that have been discovered, or here in the United States Department of Homeland Security staffers, where they confirm each other's biases, where they complain about how they're being victimized by critics, and those are seen in the population at large, where we tend to congregate with people who think like we do. And I'm wondering if you think because much has been written about social media, are the algorithms that Facebook and Twitter design, do those amplify the ways in which human beings tend to congregate with one another? Or is it that our human nature dictates how social media ends up polarizing us even more, which came before the chicken or the egg?
It is a chicken and an egg situation, absolutely. And I think both, we do have this propensity. We do have a tendency to stick with people, as I said, who are more like us. We naturally gravitate towards people. And that's why for a while there was this whole discussion on Instagram about finding your tribe and finding people who are like you, who think like you and follow the same hashtags. And that kind of creates this bubble, this filter bubble where all the other different views, diverse views, are filtered out in a very simplistic manner. But the algorithms obviously work like that as well. They polarize people. And we saw that in Brexit here, how it was manipulated and used in terms of the Brexit vote.
I should mention to our audience that you're joining us from the UK. Yeah.
I am in the UK, and that's why probably I look so tired. It's late night. It's late. Yet. Yes, so I'm talking about the EU, the vote that was held here a few years ago. So the algorithms are manipulated like that, but the algorithms work that they show what you naturally engage with more. So that means that you will only see views that you agree with. You will only mostly see posts from people who you engage more with or interact more with, and more likely to see only those views. So I think it works both ways. And I think it takes real effort to step outside of these.
Do you think that implicit bias and unconscious bias and these things that we're talking about are also relevant when we talk about extremist hate? I mean, we all carry unconscious biases within ourselves, whether we want to admit it or not. There are plenty of people who consider themselves liberals who end up succumbing to racist stereotypes, or men who consider themselves feminist who end up, being sexist. But then there's the end of the spectrum where extremism resides, where there's a very explicit acknowledgement or claim that certain races or genders are superior to others. Is that a different kind of conversation or different kind of behavioral science at work there?
In terms of the bias, I think bias doesn't really start off as implicit, unconscious, or conscious. I think we need to think about how this pyramid of bias that leads from bias to prejudice to discrimination to active outright, these kind of discriminatory hate, explicit behaviors like we see with in hate crimes and extremist views. And so so all of us have some form of biases inbuilt in us. And sometimes these biases, slowly, we feel like we are in our tribe or in a group where we can acknowledge them, accept them, and they become reinforced. And we start believing that these are the real views. These are the only views that matter. And I think it is a different conversation, because there is no implicit nature of or subversive hate crime in there. It is very explicit that they believe in a racial hierarchy. It is very explicit that these people believe in superiority of one race over another. And I think that needs a different kind of intervention. That needs a different kind of engagement. And I'm not really sure how that would work.
Well, finally, you said you're writing a book about children, talking to children about bias. And I'm wondering if you can give us a little preview here, for parents that are listening, whether they're white or non-white parents. You and I are both Indian. Our children fall within somewhere between that spectrum of black and white. We can be both victims and perpetrators of racism. Is it important for us to think about expanding our tribe, if you will, in terms of what we expose our children to? That if our friend circle is too homogeneous, that's a problem, because those are the things that our kids grow up with? And should we also be talking to our kids very explicitly, the dinner table conversations about racism and sexism?
Absolutely. I firmly believe that. So this book is coming out in October in the UK with Dialogue, but I think soon after in the US with Dialogue Books, their publisher, Hachette. And it is dealing from ages almost from birth or from 1 year to 12 years, because I think those early years really matter a lot in terms of how stereotypes get ingrained. And I really believe that we have to actively start talking about race and racism from a young age, because a lot of the parents take the colorblind approach we want to protect our children's innocence, and we tell them everybody's equal no matter the skin color. And I think that's a really wrong approach to take. We have to expose our children to the fact that skin color can create differences in our society, and that people can discriminate on the basis of that. And that means that we need to have a proactive approach to this, where we raise color conscious children. And yes, absolutely, they should be exposed in more multicultural society. They should have diverse books, diverse toys. They should have books and toys that shatter these stereotypes, the media, the cartoons they watch. We have to actively challenge these things. And it takes work. But I think that has to become a part of the conversation, both for white parents, but also for other ethnicity and the background as well. We know about anti-Black sentiment in South Asian communities as well. And my children are mixed heritage, and that creates another layer of complexity, because I have to make sure that they acknowledge the white privilege they have, but also are aware of some of the racism they might face because of one side of their heritage. And so these are the conversations that I'm having in the books, and the book is structured around these questions that sometimes children ask as they're growing up, and that parents feel really uncomfortable about, and they don't know, have the right vocabulary to talk to their children. For instance, my daughter came back from nursery the other day and said she wanted blonde hair because it's prettier. And so we had to have this whole conversation around identity and why that is really important, that she really loves herself no matter what. And also the fact, why is this hierarchy created through the media that she was seeing or through the books that she was reading, that blonde hair is prettier? And I think as parents, we have to address some of these things really head on from a very young age. So the book is designed like that. It's based around tools, vocabulary in a very conversational tone to help parents navigate some of these challenging conversations so that we can raise our children to be really assured of their own racial identity, no matter what the background.
Dr. Pragya Agarwal, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time and your insight.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest is Dr. Pragya Agarwal, and she's a behavioral scientist whose latest book that we've just been discussing is entitled Sway, Unraveling Unconscious Bias. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.